A universal is merely a sign of many things. As to this, Ockham agrees with Aquinas as against Averroes, Avicenna, and the Augustinians. Both hold that there are only individual things, individual minds, and acts of understanding. Both Aquinas and Ockham, it is true, admit to the universali ante rem, but only to explain creation. It had to be in the mind of God before he could create. But this belongs to theology, not to the explanation of human knowledge, which is only concerned with the universali post rem. In explaining human knowledge, Ockham never allows universals to be things. Socrates is similar to Plato, he says, but not in virtue of a third thing called similarity. Similarity is a term of second intention and is in the mind. All this is good. Propositions about future contingents, according to Ockham, are not yet either true or false. He makes no attempt to reconcile this view with divine omniscience. Here, as elsewhere, he keeps logic free from metaphysics and theology. Some samples of Ockham's discussions may be useful. He asks, whether that which is known by the understanding, first according to a primacy of generation, is the individual. Against, the universal is the first and proper object of the understanding. 4. The object of sense and the object of understanding are the same, but the individual is the first object of sense. Accordingly, the meaning of the question must be stated, presumably because both arguments seem strong. He continues, the thing outside the soul which is not a sign is understood first by such knowledge, that is, by knowledge which is individual. Therefore, the individual is known first, since everything outside the soul is individual. He goes on to say that abstract knowledge always presupposes knowledge which is intuitive, that is, of perception, and this is caused by individual things. He then enumerates 4 doubts which may arise and proceeds to resolve them. He concludes with an affirmative answer to his original question, but adds that the universal is the first object by primacy of adequation, not by the primacy of generation. The question involved is whether or how far perception is the source of knowledge. It will be remembered that Plato, in the Theaetetus, rejects the definition of knowledge as perception. Ockham pretty certainly did not know the Theaetetus, but if he had, he would have disagreed with it. To the question whether the sensitive soul and the intellective soul are really distinct in man, he answers that they are, though this is hard to prove. One of his arguments is that we may with our appetites desire something which with our understanding we reject. Therefore, appetite and understanding belong to different subjects. Another argument is that sensations are subjectively in the sensitive soul, but not subjectively in the intellective soul. Again, the sensitive soul is extended and material, while the intellective soul is neither. 4 objections are considered, all theological, but they are answered. Footnote. For instance, between Good Friday and Easter, Christ's soul descended into hell, whereas his body remained in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. If the sensitive soul is distinct from the intellective soul, did Christ's sensitive soul spend this time in hell or in the tomb? End of footnote. The view taken by Ockham on this question is not perhaps what might be expected. However, he agrees with St. Thomas and disagrees with Averroes in thinking that each man's intellect is his own, not something impersonal. By insisting on the possibility of studying logic and human knowledge without reference to metaphysics and theology, Ockham's work encouraged scientific research. The Augustinians, he said, erred in first supposing things unintelligible and men unintelligent, and then adding a light from infinity by which knowledge became possible. He agreed in this with Aquinas, but differed in emphasis, for Aquinas was primarily a theologian, and Ockham was, so far as logic is concerned, primarily a secular philosopher. His attitude gave confidence to students of particular problems. For instance, his immediate follower, Nicholas of Orem, died 1382, who investigated planetary theory. This man was, to a certain extent, a precursor of Copernicus. He set forth both the geocentric and the heliocentric theories, and said that each would explain all the facts known in his day, so that there was no way of deciding between them. After William of Ockham, there are no more great scholastics. The next period for great philosophers began in the late Renaissance. Chapter 15. the eclipse of the papacy. The 13th century had brought to completion a great synthesis, philosophical, theological, political, and social, which had been slowly built up by the combination of many elements. The first element was pure Greek philosophy, especially the philosophies of Pythagoras, Parmenides, Plato, and Aristotle. Then came, as a result of Alexander's conquests, a great influx of Oriental beliefs. These, taking advantage of Orphism and the mysteries, transformed the outlook of the Greek-speaking world, and ultimately of the Latin-speaking world also. The dying and resurrected God, the sacramental eating of what purported to be the flesh of the God, the second birth into a new life through some ceremony analogous to baptism, came to be part of the theology of large sections of the pagan Roman world. With these was associated an ethic of liberation from bondage to the flesh, which was, at least theoretically, ascetic. From Syria, Egypt, Babylonia, and Persia came the institution of a priesthood separated from the lay population, possessed of more or less magical powers, and able to exert considerable political influence. Impressive rituals, largely connected with belief in a life after death, came from the same sources. From Persia in particular came a dualism which regarded the world as the battleground of two great hosts, one which was good, led by Ahura Mazda, the other which was evil, led by Ahriman. Black magic was the kind that was worked by the help of Ahriman and his followers in the world of spirits. Satan is a development of Ahriman. This influx of barbarian ideas and practices was synthesized with certain Hellenic elements in the Neoplatonic philosophy. In Orphism, Pythagoreanism, and some parts of Plato, the Greeks had developed points of view which were easy to combine with those of the Orient, perhaps because they had been borrowed from the East at a much earlier time. With Plotinus and Porphyry, the development of pagan philosophy ends. The thought of these men, however, though deeply religious, was not capable, without much transformation, of inspiring a victorious popular religion. Their philosophy was difficult and could not be generally understood. Their way of salvation was too intellectual for the masses. Their conservatism led them to uphold the traditional religion of Greece, which, however, they had to interpret allegorically in order to soften its immoral elements and to reconcile it with their philosophical monotheism. The Greek religion had fallen into decay, being unable to compete with Eastern rituals and theologies. The oracles had become silent, and the priesthood had never formed a powerful, distinct caste. The attempt to revive Greek religion had therefore an archaistic character, which gave it a certain feebleness and pedantry, especially noticeable in the Emperor Julian. Already in the 3rd century, it could have been foreseen that some Asiatic religion would conquer the Roman world, though at that time there were still several competitors which all seemed to have a chance of victory. Christianity combined elements of strength from various sources. From the Jews, it accepted a sacred book and the doctrine that all religions but one are false and evil. But it avoided the racial exclusiveness of the Jews and the inconveniences of the Mosaic law. Later, Judaism had already learnt to believe in the life after death, but the Christians gave a new definiteness to heaven and hell and to the ways of reaching the one and escaping the other. Easter combined the Jewish Passover with pagan celebrations of the resurrected God. Persian dualism was absorbed, but with a firmer assurance of the ultimate omnipotence of the good principle and with the addition that the pagan gods were followers of Satan. At first, the Christians were not the equals of their adversaries in philosophy or in ritual, but gradually these deficiencies were made good. At first, philosophy was more advanced among the semi-Christian Gnostics than among the Orthodox. But from the time of Origen onwards, the Christians developed an adequate philosophy by modification of Neoplatonism. Ritual among the early Christians is a somewhat obscure subject, but at any rate by the time of St. Ambrose it had become extremely impressive. The power and the separateness of the priesthood were taken from the East, but were gradually strengthened by methods of government in the Church, which owed much to the practice of the Roman Empire. The Old Testament, the mystery religions, Greek philosophy, and Roman methods of administration were all blended in the Catholic Church and combined to give it a strength which no earlier social organization had equaled. The Western Church, like ancient Rome, developed, though more slowly, from a republic into a monarchy. We have seen the stages in the growth of papal power from Gregory the Great through Nicholas I, Gregory VII, and Innocent III, to the final defeat of the Hohenstaufen in the Wars of Guelphs and Ghibellines. At the same time, Christian philosophy, which had hitherto been Augustinian and therefore largely Platonic, was enriched by new elements due to contact with Constantinople and the Mohammedans. Aristotle, during the 13th century, came to be known fairly completely in the West, and, by the influence of Albertus Magnus and Thomas Aquinas, was established in the minds of the learned as the supreme authority after Scripture and the Church. Down to the present day, he has retained this position among Catholic philosophers. I cannot but think that the substitution of Aristotle for Plato and St. Augustine was a mistake from the Christian point of view. Plato's temperament was more religious than Aristotle's, and Christian theology had been, from almost the first, adapted to Platonism. Plato had taught that knowledge is not perception, but a kind of reminiscent vision. Aristotle was much more of an empiricist. St. Thomas, little though he intended it, prepared the way for the return from Platonic dreaming to scientific observation. Outward events had more to do than philosophy with the disintegration of the Catholic synthesis which began in the 14th century. The Byzantine Empire was conquered by the Latins in 1204 and remained in their hands till 1261. During this time, the religion of its government was Catholic, not Greek. But after 1261, Constantinople was lost to the Pope and never recovered, in spite of nominal union at Ferrara in 1438. The defeat of the Western Empire and its conflict with the papacy proved useless to the Church, owing to the rise of national monarchies in France and England. Throughout most of the 14th century, the Pope was politically a tool in the hands of the King of France. More important than these causes was the rise of a rich commercial class and the increase of knowledge in the laity. Both of these began in Italy and remained more advanced in that country than in other parts of the West until the middle of the 16th century. North Italian cities were much richer in the 14th century than any of the cities of the North, and learned laymen, especially in law and medicine, were becoming increasingly numerous. The cities had a spirit of independence, which, now that the emperor was no longer a menace, was apt to turn against the Pope. But the same movements, though to a lesser degree, existed elsewhere. Flanders prospered, so did the Hanse towns. In England, the wool trade was a source of wealth. The age was one in which tendencies which may be broadly called democratic were very strong, and nationalistic tendencies were even stronger. The papacy, which had become very worldly, appeared largely as a taxing agency, drawing to itself vast revenues which most countries wished to retain at home. The popes no longer had, or deserved, the moral authority which had given them power. St. Francis had been able to work in harmony with Innocent III and Gregory IX, but the most earnest men of the 14th century were driven into conflict with the papacy. At the beginning of the century, however, these causes of decline in the papacy were not yet apparent. Boniface VIII, in the bull Unum Sanctum, made more extreme claims than had ever been made by any previous pope. He instituted, in 1300, the year of Jubilee, when plenary indulgence is granted to all Catholics who visit Rome and perform certain ceremonies while there. This brought immense sums of money to the coffers of the curia and the pockets of the Roman people. There was to be a jubilee every 100th year, but the profits were so great that the period was shortened to 50 years, and then to 25, at which it remains to the present day. The first jubilee, that of 1300, showed the Pope at the summit of his success, and may be conveniently regarded as the date from which the decline began. Boniface VIII was an Italian. Born at Anagni, he had been besieged in the Tower of London when in England, on behalf of the Pope to support Henry III against the rebellious barons, but he was rescued in 1267 by the king's son, afterwards Edward I. There was already in his day a powerful French party in the Church, and his election was opposed by the French cardinals. He came into violent conflict with the French king, Philip IV, on the question whether the king had the right to tax the French clergy. Boniface was addicted to nepotism and avarice. He therefore wished to retain control over as many sources of revenue as possible. He was accused of heresy, probably with justice. It seems that he was an Averroist and did not believe in immortality. His quarrel with the king of France became so bitter that the king sent a force to arrest him, with a view to his being deposed by a general council. He was caught at Anagni, but escaped to Rome, where he died. After this, for a long time, no pope ventured to oppose the King of France. After a very brief intermediate reign, the cardinals in 1305 elected the Archbishop of Bordeaux, who took the name of Clement V. He was a Gascon, and consistently represented the French party in the church. Throughout his pontificate, he never went to Italy. He was crowned in Lyon, and in 1309 he settled in Avignon, where the popes remained for about 70 years. Clement V signalized his alliance with the King of France by their joint action against the Templars. Both needed money. The Pope, because he was addicted to favoritism and nepotism, Philip for the English War, the Flemish Revolt, and the costs of an increasingly energetic government. After he had plundered the bankers of Lombardy and persecuted the Jews to the limit of what the traffic would bear, it occurred to him that the Templars, in addition to being bankers, had immense landed estates in France, which, with the Pope's help, he might acquire. It was therefore arranged that the Church should discover that the Templars had fallen into heresy and that King and Pope should share the spoils. On a given day in 1307, all the leading Templars in France were arrested. A list of leading questions, previously drawn up, was put to them all. Under torture, they confessed that they had done homage to Satan and committed various other abominations. At last, in 1313, the Pope suppressed the order, and all its property was confiscated. The best account of this proceeding is in Henry C. Lee's History of the Inquisition, where, after full investigation, the conclusion is reached that the charges against the Templars were wholly without foundation. In the case of the Templars, the financial interests of Pope and King coincided, but on most occasions, in most parts of Christendom, they conflicted. In the time of Boniface VIII, Philip IV had secured the support of the estates, even the estate of the Church, in his disputes with the Pope as to taxation. When the popes became politically subservient to France, the sovereigns, hostile to the French king, were necessarily hostile to the Pope. This led to the protection of William of Ockham and the Marsilio of Padua by the Emperor. At a slightly later date, it led to the protection of Wycliffe by John of Gaunt. Bishops in general were by this time completely in subjection to the Pope. In an increasing proportion, they were actually appointed by him. The monastic orders and the Dominicans were equally obedient, but the Franciscans still had a certain spirit of independence. This led to their conflict with John XXII, 1316-34, which we have already considered in connection with William of Ockham. During this conflict, Marsilio persuaded the emperor to march on Rome, where the imperial crown was conferred on him by the populace, and a Franciscan antipope was elected after the populace had declared John XXII deposed. However, nothing came of all this beyond a general diminution of respect for the papacy. The revolt against papal domination took different forms in different places. Sometimes it was associated with monarchical nationalism, sometimes with a Puritan horror of the corruption and worldliness of the papal court. In Rome itself, the revolt was associated with an archaistic democracy. Under Clement VI, 1342-52, Rome for a time sought to free itself from the absentee pope under the leadership of a remarkable man, Cola di Rienzi. Rome suffered not only from the rule of the popes, but also from the local aristocracy, which continued the turbulence that had degraded the papacy in the 10th century. Indeed, it was partly to escape from the lawless Roman nobles that the popes had fled to Avignon. At first, Rienzi, who was the son of a tavern keeper, rebelled only against the nobles, and in this he had the support of the pope. He roused so much popular enthusiasm that the nobles fled, 1347. Petrarch, who admired him and wrote an ode to him, urged him to continue his great and noble work. He took the title of tribune and proclaimed the sovereignty of the Roman people over the empire. He seems to have conceived this sovereignty democratically, for he called representatives from the Italian cities to a sort of parliament. Success, however, gave him delusions of grandeur. At this time, as at many others, there were rival claimants to the empire. Rienzi summoned both of them, and the electors to come before him to have the issue decided. This naturally turned both imperial candidates against him, and also the Pope, who considered that it was for him to pronounce judgment in such matters. Rienzi was captured by the Pope, 1352, and kept in prison for 2 years until Clement VI died. Then he was released and returned to Rome, where he acquired power again for a few months. On this second occasion, however, his popularity was brief, and in the end he was murdered by the mob. Byron, as well as Petrarch, wrote a poem in his praise. It became evident that if the papacy was to remain effectively the head of the whole Catholic Church, it must free itself from dependence on France by returning to Rome. Moreover, the Anglo-French War, in which France was suffering severe defeats, made France unsafe. Urban V therefore went to Rome in 1367, but Italian politics were too complicated for him, and he returned to Avignon shortly before his death. The next pope, Gregory XI, was more resolute. Hostility to the French Curia had made many Italian towns, especially Florence, bitterly anti-papal. But by returning to Rome and opposing the French cardinals, Gregory did everything in his power to save the situation. However, at his death, the French and Roman parties in the College of Cardinals proved irreconcilable. In accordance with the wishes of the Roman party, an Italian, Bartolomeo Prignano, was elected and took the name of Urban VI. But a number of cardinals declared his election uncanonical and proceeded to elect Robert of Geneva, who belonged to the French party. He took the name of Clement VII and lived in Avignon. Thus began the Great Schism, which lasted for some 40 years. France, of course, recognized the Avignon Pope, and the enemies of France recognized the Roman Pope. Scotland was the enemy of England, and England of France, therefore Scotland, recognized the Avignon Pope. Each pope chose cardinals from among his own partisans, and when either died, his cardinals quickly elected another. Thus, there was no way of healing the schism except by bringing to bear some power superior to both popes. It was clear that one of them must be legitimate, therefore a power superior to a legitimate pope had to be found. The only solution lay in a general council. The University of Paris, led by Gerson, developed a new theory giving powers of initiative to a council. The lay sovereigns, to whom the schism was inconvenient, lent their support. At last, in 1409, a council was summoned and met at Pisa. It failed, however, in a ridiculous manner. It declared both popes deposed for heresy and schism and elected a third, who promptly died. But his cardinals elected as his successor an ex-pirate named Baldassare Cossa, who took the name of John XXIII. Thus, the net result was that there were three popes instead of two, the conciliar pope being a notorious ruffian. At this stage, the situation seemed more hopeless than ever. But the supporters of the conciliar movement did not give in. In 1414, a new council was summoned at Constance and proceeded to vigorous action. It first decreed that popes cannot dissolve councils and must submit to them in certain respects. It also decided that future popes must summon a general council every 7 years. It deposed John XXIII and induced the Roman pope to resign. The Avignon pope refused to resign, and after his death, the King of Aragon caused a successor to be elected. But France, at this time at the mercy of England, refused to recognize him, and his party dwindled into insignificance and finally ceased to exist. Thus, at last, there was no opposition to the pope chosen by the council, who was elected in 1417 and took the name of Martin V. These proceedings were creditable, but the treatment of Hus, the Bohemian disciple of Wycliffe, was not. He was brought to Constance with the promise of a safe conduct, but when he got there, he was condemned and suffered death at the stake. Wycliffe was safely dead, but the council ordered his bones dug up and burnt. The supporters of the conciliar movement were anxious to free themselves from all suspicion of unorthodoxy. The Council of Constance had healed the schism, but it had hoped to do much more, and to substitute a constitutional monarchy for the papal absolutism. Martin V had made many promises before his election. Some he kept, some he broke. He had assented to the decree that a council should be summoned every 7 years, and to this decree he remained obedient. The Council of Constance having been dissolved in 1417, a new council, which proved of no importance, was summoned in 1424. Then in 1431 another was convoked to meet at Basel. Martin V died just at this moment, and his successor, Eugenius IV, was, throughout his pontificate, in bitter conflict with the reformers who controlled the council. He dissolved the council, but it refused to consider itself dissolved. In 1433 he gave way for a time, but in 1437 he dissolved it again. Nevertheless, it remained in session till 1448, by which time it was obvious to all that the Pope had won a complete triumph. In 1439, the council had alienated sympathy by declaring the Pope deposed and electing an anti-pope, the last in history, who, however, resigned almost immediately. In the same year, Eugenius IV won prestige by holding a council of his own at Ferrara, where the Greek Church, in desperate fear of the Turks, made a nominal submission to Rome. The papacy thus emerged politically triumphant, but with very greatly diminished power of inspiring moral reverence. Wycliffe, circa 1320-84, illustrates by his life and doctrine the diminished authority of the papacy in the 14th century. Unlike the earlier schoolmen, he was a secular priest, not a monk or friar. He had a great reputation in Oxford, where he became a doctor of theology in 1372. For a short time, he was master of Balliol. He was the last of the important Oxford scholastics. As a philosopher, he was not progressive. He was a realist and a Platonist rather than an Aristotelian. He held that God's decrees are not arbitrary, as some maintained. The actual world is not one among possible worlds, but is the only possible world, since God is bound to choose what is best. All this is not what makes him interesting, nor does it seem to have been what most interested him, for he retired from Oxford to the life of a country clergyman. During the last 10 years of his life, he was the parish priest of Lutterworth by crown appointment. He continued, however, to lecture at Oxford. Wycliffe is remarkable for the extreme slowness of his development. In 1372, when his age was 50 or more, he was still orthodox. It was only after this date, apparently, that he became heretical. He seems to have been driven into heresy entirely by the strength of his moral feelings, his sympathy with the poor, and his horror of rich worldly ecclesiastics. At first, his attack on the papacy was only political and moral, not doctrinal. It was only gradually that he was driven into wider revolt. Wycliffe's departure from orthodoxy began in 1376 with a course of lectures at Oxford on civil dominion. He advanced the theory that righteousness alone gives the title to dominion and property, that unrighteous clergy have no such title, and that the decision as to whether an ecclesiastic should retain his property or not ought to be taken by the civil power. He taught further that property is the result of sin. Christ and the apostles had no property, ought to have none. These doctrines offended all clerics except the friars. The English government, however, favoured them, for the Pope drew a huge tribute from England, and the doctrine that money should not be sent out of England to the Pope was a convenient one. This was especially the case while the Pope was subservient to France, and England was at war with France. John of Gaunt, who held power during the minority of Richard II, befriended Wycliffe as long as possible. Gregory XI, on the other hand, condemned 18 theses in Wycliffe's lectures, saying that they were derived from Marsilio of Padua. Wycliffe was summoned to appear for trial before a tribunal of bishops, but the Queen and the mob protected him, while the University of Oxford refused to admit the Pope's jurisdiction over its teachers. Even in those days, English universities believed in academic freedom. Meanwhile, Wycliffe continued, during 1378 and 1379, to write learned treatises, maintaining that the king is God's vicar and that bishops are subject to him. When the Great Schism came, he went further than before, branding the Pope as Antichrist, and saying that acceptance of the donation of Constantine had made all subsequent popes apostates. He translated the Vulgate into English and established poor priests, who were secular. By this action he at last annoyed the friars. He employed the poor priests as itinerant preachers, whose mission was especially to the poor. At last, in attacking sacerdotal power, he was led to deny transubstantiation, which he called a deceit and a blasphemous folly. At this point, John of Gaunt ordered him to be silent. The Peasants' Revolt of 1381, led by Wat Tyler, made matters more difficult for Wycliffe. There is no evidence that he actively encouraged it, but unlike Luther in similar circumstances, he refrained from condemning it. John Ball, the socialist unfrocked priest who was one of the leaders, admired Wycliffe, which was embarrassing. But as he had been excommunicated in 1366, when Wycliffe was still orthodox, he must have arrived independently at his opinions. Wycliffe's communistic opinions, though no doubt the poor priests disseminated them, were by him only stated in Latin, so that at first hand they were inaccessible to peasants. It is surprising that Wycliffe did not suffer more than he did for his opinions and his democratic activities. The University of Oxford defended him against the bishops as long as possible. When the House of Lords condemned his itinerant preachers, the House of Commons refused to concur. No doubt trouble would have accumulated if he had lived longer, but when he died in 1384, he had not yet been formally condemned. He was buried at Lutterworth, where he died, and his bones were left in peace until the Council of Constance had them dug up and burnt. His followers in England, the Lollards, were severely persecuted and practically stamped out, but owing to the fact that Richard II's wife was a Bohemian, his doctrines became known in Bohemia, where Hus was his disciple, and in Bohemia, in spite of persecution, they survived until the Reformation. In England, although driven underground, the revolt against the papacy remained in men's thoughts and prepared the soil for Protestantism. During the 15th century, various other causes were added to the decline of the papacy to produce a very rapid change, both political and cultural. Gunpowder strengthened central governments at the expense of the feudal nobility. In France and England, Louis XI and Edward IV allied themselves with the rich middle class, who helped them to quell aristocratic anarchy. Italy, until the last years of the century, was fairly free from northern armies and advanced rapidly both in wealth and culture. The new culture was essentially pagan, admiring Greece and Rome and despising the Middle Ages. Architecture and literary style were adapted to ancient models. When Constantinople, the last survival of antiquity, was captured by the Turks, Greek refugees in Italy were welcomed by humanists. Vasco da Gama and Columbus enlarged the world, and Copernicus enlarged the heavens. The donation of Constantine was rejected as a fable and overwhelmed with scholarly derision. By the help of the Byzantines, Plato came to be known not only in Neoplatonic and Augustinian versions, but at first hand. This sublunary sphere appeared no longer as a vale of tears, a place of painful pilgrimage to another world, but as affording opportunity for pagan delights, for fame and beauty and adventure. The long centuries of asceticism were forgotten in a riot of art and poetry and pleasure. Even in Italy, it is true, the Middle Ages did not die without a struggle. Savonarola and Leonardo were born in the same year. But in the main, the old terrors had ceased to be terrifying, and the new liberty of the spirit was found intoxicating. The intoxication could not last, but for the moment it shut out fear. In this moment of joyful liberation, the modern world was born. Book 3. Modern Philosophy. Part 1. From the Renaissance to Hume. Chapter 1. General Characteristics. The period of history which is commonly called modern has a mental outlook which differs from that of the medieval period in many ways. Of these, two are the most important: the diminishing authority of the Church and the increasing authority of science. With these two, others are connected. The culture of modern times is more lay than clerical. States increasingly replace the Church as the governmental authority that controls culture. The government of nations is at first mainly in the hands of kings. Then, as in ancient Greece, the kings are gradually replaced by democracies or tyrants. The power of the national state and the functions that it performs grows steadily throughout the whole period, apart from some minor fluctuations. But at most times, the state has less influence on the opinions of philosophers than the Church had in the Middle Ages. The feudal aristocracy, which north of the Alps had been able, till the 15th century, to hold its own against central governments, loses first its political and then its economic importance. It is replaced by the king in alliance with rich merchants. These two share power in different proportions in different countries. There is a tendency for the rich merchants to become absorbed into the aristocracy. From the time of the American and French revolutions onwards, democracy, in the modern sense, becomes an important political force. Socialism, as opposed to democracy, based on private property, first acquires governmental power in 1917. This form of government, however, if it spreads, must obviously bring with it a new form of culture. The culture with which we shall be concerned is in the main liberal, that is to say, of the kind most naturally associated with commerce. To this, there are important exceptions, especially in Germany. Fichte and Hegel, to take two examples, have an outlook which is totally unconnected with commerce, but such exceptions are not typical of their age. The rejection of ecclesiastical authority, which is the negative characteristic of the modern age, begins earlier than the positive characteristic, which is the acceptance of scientific authority. In the Italian Renaissance, science played a very small part. The opposition to the church in men's thoughts was connected with antiquity and looked still to the past, but to a more distant past than that of the early church in the Middle Ages. The first serious eruption of science was the publication of the Copernican theory in 1543, but this theory did not become influential until it was taken up and improved by Kepler and Galileo in the 17th century. Then began the long fight between science and dogma, in which traditionalists fought a losing battle against new knowledge. The authority of science, which is recognized by most philosophers of the modern epoch, is a very different thing from the authority of the church, since it is intellectual, not governmental. No penalties fall upon those who reject it. No prudential arguments influence those who accept it. It prevails solely by its intrinsic appeal to reason. It is, moreover, a piecemeal and partial authority. It does not, like the body of Catholic dogma, lay down a complete system covering human morality, human hopes, and the past and future history of the universe. It pronounces only on whatever at the time appears to have been scientifically ascertained, which is a small island in an ocean of nescience. There is yet another difference from ecclesiastical authority, which declares its pronouncements to be absolutely certain and eternally unalterable. The pronouncements of science are made tentatively, on a basis of probability, and are regarded as liable to modification. This produces a temper of mind very different from that of the medieval dogmatist. So far, I have been speaking of theoretical science, which is an attempt to understand the world. Practical science, which is an attempt to change the world, has been important from the first, and has continually increased in importance until it has almost ousted theoretical science from men's thoughts. The practical importance of science was first recognized in connection with war. Galileo and Leonardo obtained government employment by their claim to improve artillery and the art of fortification. From their time onwards, the part of the men of science in war has steadily grown greater. Their part in developing machine production and accustoming the population to the use first of steam, then of electricity, came later and did not begin to have important political effects until near the end of the 18th century. The triumph of science has been mainly due to its practical utility, and there has been an attempt to divorce this aspect from that of theory, thus making science more and more a technique and less a doctrine as to the nature of the world. The penetration of this point of view to the philosophers is very recent. Emancipation from the authority of the church led to the growth of individualism, even to the point of anarchy. Discipline, intellectual, moral, and political, was associated in the minds of the men of the Renaissance with a scholastic philosophy and ecclesiastical government. The Aristotelian logic of the schoolmen was narrow, but afforded a training in a certain kind of accuracy. When this school of logic became unfashionable, it was not at first succeeded by something better, but only by an eclectic imitation of ancient models. Until the 17th century, there was nothing of importance in philosophy. The moral and political anarchy of 15th century Italy was appalling and gave rise to the doctrines of Machiavelli. At the same time, the freedom from mental shackles led to an astonishing display of genius in art and literature. But such a society is unstable. The Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, combined with the subjection of Italy to Spain, put an end to both the good and the bad of the Italian Renaissance. When the movement spread north of the Alps, it had not the same anarchic character. Modern philosophy, however, has retained, for the most part, an individualistic and subjective character. This is very marked in Descartes, who builds up all knowledge from the certainty of his own existence and accepts clearness and distinctness, both subjective, as criteria of truth. It is not prominent in Spinoza, but reappears in Leibniz's Windowless Monads. Locke, whose temperament is thoroughly objective, is forced reluctantly into the subjective doctrine that knowledge is of the agreement or disagreement of ideas, a view so repulsive to him that he escapes from it by violent inconsistencies. Berkeley, after abolishing matter, is only saved from complete subjectivism by use of God, which most subsequent philosophers have regarded as illegitimate. In Hume, the empiricist philosophy culminated in a scepticism which none could refute and none could accept. Kant and Fichte were subjective in temperament as well as in doctrine. Hegel saved himself by means of the influence of Spinoza. Rousseau and the Romantic movement extended subjectivity from theory of knowledge to ethics and politics, and ended logically in complete anarchism, such as that of Bakunin. This extreme of subjectivism is a form of madness. Meanwhile, science's technique was building up in practical men a quite different outlook from any that was to be found among theoretical philosophers. Technique conferred a sense of power. Man is now much less at the mercy of his environment than he was in former times. But the power conferred by technique is social, not individual. An average individual wrecked on a desert island could have achieved more in the 17th century than he could now. Scientific technique requires the cooperation of a large number of individuals organized under a single direction. Its tendency, therefore, is against anarchism and even individualism, since it demands a well-knit social structure. Unlike religion, it is ethically neutral. It assures man that they can perform wonders, but does not tell them what wonders to perform. In this way, it is incomplete. In practice, the purposes to which scientific skill will be devoted depend largely on chance. The men at the head of the vast organizations which it necessitates can, within limits, turn it this way or that as they please. The power impulse thus has a scope which it never had before. The philosophies that have been inspired by scientific technique are power philosophies and tend to regard everything non-human as mere raw material. Ends are no longer considered. Only the skillfulness of the process is valued. This also is a form of madness. It is in our day the most dangerous form, and the one against which a sane philosophy should provide an antidote. The ancient world found an end to anarchy in the Roman Empire. But the Roman Empire was a brute fact, not an idea. The Catholic world sought an end to anarchy in the Church, which was an idea, but was never adequately embodied in fact. Neither the ancient nor the medieval solution was satisfactory, the one because it could not be idealized, the other because it could not be actualized. The modern world at present seems to be moving towards a solution like that of antiquity, a social order imposed by force, representing the will of the powerful rather than the hopes of common men. The problem of a durable and satisfactory social order can only be solved by combining the solidity of the Roman Empire with the idealism of St. Augustine's City of God. To achieve this, a new philosophy will be needed. Chapter 2. The Italian Renaissance. The modern, as opposed to the medieval outlook, began in Italy with a movement called the Renaissance. At first, only a few individuals, notably Petrarch, had this outlook. But during the 15th century, it spread to the great majority of cultivated Italians, both lay and clerical. In some respects, Italians of the Renaissance, with the exception of Leonardo and a few others, had not the respect for science which has characterized most important innovators since the 17th century. With this lack is associated their very partial emancipation from superstition, especially in the form of astrology. Many of them had still the reverence for authority that medieval philosophers had had, but they substituted the authority of the ancients for that of the Church. This was, of course, a step towards emancipation, since the ancients disagreed with each other, and individual judgment was required to decide which of them to follow. But very few Italians of the 15th century would have dared to hold an opinion for which no authority could be found either in antiquity or in the teaching of the Church. To understand the Renaissance, it is necessary first to review briefly the political condition of Italy. After the death of Frederick II in 1250, Italy was, in the main, free from foreign interference until the French king, Charles VIII, invaded the country in 1494. There were in Italy five important states: Milan, Venice, Florence, the Papal Domain, and Naples. In addition to these, there were a number of small principalities, which varied in their alliance with or subjection to some one of the larger states. Until 1378, Genoa rivaled Venice in commerce and naval power, But after that year, Genoa became subject to Milanese suzerainty. Milan, which led the resistance to feudalism in the 12th and 13th centuries, fell after the final defeat of the Hohenstaufen under the dominion of the Visconti, an able family whose power was plutocratic, not feudal. They ruled for 170 years, from 1277 to 1447. Then, after 3 years of restored republican government, a new family, that of the Sforza, connected with the Visconti, acquired the government and took the title of Dukes of Milan. From 1494 to 1535, Milan was a battleground between the French and the Spaniards. The Sforza allied themselves sometimes with one side, sometimes with the other. During this period, they were sometimes in exile, sometimes in nominal control. Finally, in 1535, Milan was annexed by the Emperor Charles V. The Republic of Venice stands somewhat outside Italian politics, especially in the earlier centuries of its greatness. It had never been conquered by the barbarians, and at first regarded itself as subject to the Eastern emperors. This tradition, combined with the fact that its trade was with the East, gave it an independence of Rome, which still persisted down to the time of the Council of Trent, 1545, of which the Venetian, Paolo Sarpi, wrote a very anti-papal history. We have seen how, at the time of the Fourth Crusade, Venice insisted upon the conquest of Constantinople. This improved Venetian trade, which conversely suffered by the Turkish conquest of Constantinople in 1453. For various reasons, partly connected with food supply, the Venetians found it necessary during the 14th and 15th centuries to acquire considerable territory on the mainland of Italy. This roused enmities, and led finally in 1509 to the formation of the League of Cambrai, a combination of powerful states by which Venice was defeated. It might have been possible to recover from this misfortune, but not from Vasco da Gama's discovery of the Cape Route to India, 1497-8. This, added to the power of the Turks, ruined Venice, which, however, lingered on until deprived of independence by Napoleon. The constitution of Venice, which had originally been democratic, became gradually less so, and was, after 1297, a close oligarchy. The basis of political power was the Great Council, membership of which, after that date, was hereditary, and was confined to the leading families. Executive power belonged to the Council of Ten, which was elected by the Great Council. The Doge, the ceremonial head of the state, was elected for life. His nominal powers were very restricted, but in practice his influence was usually decisive. Venetian diplomacy was considered exceedingly astute, and the reports of Venetian ambassadors were remarkably penetrating. Since Ranke, historians have used them as among the best sources for knowledge of the events with which they deal. Florence was the most civilized city in the world, and the chief source of the Renaissance. Almost all the great names in literature, and the earlier as well as some of the later of the great names in art, are connected with Florence. But for the present, we are concerned with politics rather than culture. In the 13th century, there were three conflicting classes in Florence: the nobles, the rich merchants, and the small men. The nobles in the main were Ghibelline, the other two classes Guelph. The Ghibellines were finally defeated in 1266, and during the 14th century, the party of the small men got the better of the rich merchants. The conflict, however, led not to a stable democracy, but to the gradual growth of what the Greeks would have called a tyranny. The Medici family, who ultimately became the rulers of Florence, began as political bosses on the democratic side. Cosimo de' Medici, 1389 to 1464, the first of the family to achieve clear preeminence, still had no official position. His power depended upon skill in manipulating elections. He was astute, conciliatory when possible, ruthless when necessary. He was succeeded, after a short interval, by his grandson Lorenzo the Magnificent, who held power from 1469 till his death in 1492. Both these men owed their position to their wealth, which they had acquired mainly in commerce, but also in mining and other industries. They understood how to make Florence rich, as well as themselves, and under them the city prospered. Lorenzo's son Pietro lacked his father's merits, and was expelled in 1494. Then followed the 4 years of Savonarola's influence, when a kind of Puritan revival turned men against gaiety and luxury, away from free thought and towards the piety supposed to have characterized a simpler age. In the end, however, mainly for political reasons, Savonarola's enemies triumphed. He was executed and his body was burnt, 1498. The Republic, democratic in intention but plutocratic in fact, survived till 1512, when the Medici were restored. A son of Lorenzo, who had become a cardinal at the age of 14, was elected pope in 1513 and took the title of Leo X. The Medici family, under the title of Grand Dukes of Tuscany, governed Florence until 1737. But Florence, meanwhile, like the rest of Italy, had become poor and unimportant. The temporal power of the pope, which owed its origin to Pepin and the forged donation of Constantine, increased greatly during the Renaissance. But the methods employed by the popes to this end robbed the papacy of spiritual authority. The conciliar movement, which came to grief in the conflict between the Council of Basel and Pope Eugenius IV, 1431 to 1447, represented the most earnest elements in the Church. What was perhaps even more important, it represented ecclesiastical opinion north of the Alps. The victory of the popes was the victory of Italy, and in a lesser degree of Spain. Italian civilization in the latter half of the 15th century was totally unlike that of northern countries, which remained medieval. The Italians were in earnest about culture, but not about morals and religion. Even in the minds of ecclesiastics, elegant Latinity would cover a multitude of sins. Nicholas V, 1447 to 1455, the first humanist pope, gave papal offices to scholars whose learning he respected, regardless of other considerations. Lorenzo Valla, an Epicurean, and the man who proved the donation of Constantine to be a forgery, who ridiculed the style of the Vulgate and accused St. Augustine of heresy, was made apostolic secretary. This policy of encouraging humanism rather than piety or orthodoxy continued until the sack of Rome in 1527. Encouragement of humanism, though it shocked the earnest North, might from our point of view be reckoned a virtue. But the warlike policy and immoral life of some of the popes could not be defended from any point of view except that of naked power politics. Alexander VI, 1492 to 1503, devoted his life as pope to the aggrandizement of himself and his family. He had two sons, the Duke of Gandia and Caesar Borgia, of whom he greatly preferred the former. The Duke, however, was murdered, probably by his brother. The Pope's dynastic ambitions therefore had to be concentrated on Caesar. Together they conquered the Romagna and Ancona, which were intended to form a principality for Caesar. But when the Pope died, Caesar was very ill and therefore could not act promptly. Their conquests consequently reverted to the patrimony of St. Peter. The wickedness of these two men soon became legendary, and it is difficult to disentangle truth from falsehood as regards the innumerable murders of which they are accused. There can be no doubt, however, that they carried the arts of perfidy further than they had ever been carried before. Julius II, 1503 to 1513, who succeeded Alexander VI, was not remarkable for piety, but gave less occasion for scandal than his predecessor. He continued the process of enlarging the papal domain. As a soldier he had merit, but not as the head of the Christian Church. The Reformation, which began under his successor, Leo X, 1513 to 1521, was the natural outcome of the pagan policy of the Renaissance popes. The southern extremity of Italy was occupied by the Kingdom of Naples, with which, at most times, Sicily was united. Naples and Sicily had been the especial personal kingdom of the Emperor Frederick II. He had introduced an absolute monarchy on the Mohammedan model, enlightened but despotic, and allowing no power to the feudal nobility. After his death in 1250, Naples and Sicily went to his natural son Manfred, who, however, inherited the implacable hostility of the Church and was ousted by the French in 1266. The French made themselves unpopular and were massacred in the Sicilian Vespers, 1282, after which the kingdom belonged to Peter III of Aragon and his heirs. After various complications, leading to the temporary separation of Naples and Sicily, they were reunited in 1443 under Alfonso the Magnanimous, a distinguished patron of letters. From 1495 onwards, three French kings tried to conquer Naples, but in the end the kingdom was acquired by Ferdinand of Aragon, 1502. Charles VIII, Louis XII, and Francis I, kings of France, all had claims, not very good in law, on Milan and Naples. All invaded Italy with temporary success, but all were ultimately defeated by the Spaniards. The victory of Spain and the Counter-Reformation put an end to the Italian Renaissance. Pope Clement VII, being an obstacle to the Counter-Reformation, and as a Medici a friend of France, Charles V in 1527 caused Rome to be sacked by a largely Protestant army. After this, the popes became religious, and the Italian Renaissance was at an end. The game of power politics in Italy was unbelievably complex. The minor princes, mostly self-made tyrants, allied themselves now with one of the larger states, now with another. If they played the game unwisely, they were exterminated. There were constant wars, but until the coming of the French in 1494, they were almost bloodless. The soldiers were mercenaries who were anxious to minimize their vocational risks. These purely Italian wars did not interfere much with trade or prevent the country from increasing in wealth. There was much statecraft, but no wise statesmanship. When the French came, the country found itself practically defenseless. French troops shocked the Italians by actually killing people in battle. The wars between French and Spaniards which ensued were serious wars, bringing suffering and impoverishment. But the Italian states went on intriguing against each other, invoking the aid of France or Spain in their internal quarrels, without any feeling for national unity. In the end, all were ruined. It must be said that Italy would inevitably have lost its importance owing to the discovery of America and the Cape Route to the east. But the collapse could have been less catastrophic and less destructive of the quality of Italian civilization. The Renaissance was not a period of great achievement in philosophy, but it did certain things which were essential preliminaries to the greatness of the 17th century. In the first place, it broke down the rigid scholastic system, which had become an intellectual straitjacket. It revived the study of Plato, and thereby demanded at least so much independent thought as was required for choosing between him and Aristotle. In regard to both, it promoted a genuine and first-hand knowledge, free from the glosses of Neoplatonists and Arabic commentators. More important still, it encouraged the habit of regarding intellectual activity as a delightful social adventure, not a cloistered meditation aiming at the preservation of a predetermined orthodoxy. The substitution of Plato for the scholastic Aristotle was hastened by contact with Byzantine scholarship. Already, at the Council of Ferrara, 1438, which nominally reunited the Eastern and Western churches, there was a debate in which the Byzantines maintained the superiority of Plato to Aristotle. Gemistus Pletho, an ardent Greek Platonist of doubtful orthodoxy, did much to promote Platonism in Italy. So did Bessarion, a Greek who became a cardinal. Cosimo and Lorenzo de' Medici were both addicted to Plato. Cosimo founded and Lorenzo continued the Florentine Academy, which was largely devoted to the study of Plato. Cosimo died listening to one of Plato's dialogues. The humanists of the time, however, were too busy acquiring knowledge of antiquity to be able to produce anything original in philosophy. The Renaissance was not a popular movement. It was a movement of a small number of scholars and artists, encouraged by liberal patrons, especially the Medici and the humanist popes. But for these patrons, it might have had very much less success. Petrarch and Boccaccio in the 14th century belong mentally to the Renaissance, but owing to the different political conditions of their time, their immediate influence was less than that of the 15th century humanists. The attitude of Renaissance scholars to the church is difficult to characterize simply. Some were avowed free thinkers, though even these usually received extreme unction, making peace with the church when they felt death approaching. Most of them were impressed by the wickedness of contemporary popes, but were nevertheless glad to be employed by them. Guicciardini, the historian, wrote in 1529, "No man is more disgusted than I am with the ambition, the avarice, and the profligacy of the priests. Not only because each of these vices is hateful in itself, but because each and all of them are most unbecoming in those who declare themselves to be men in special relations with God, and also because they are vices so opposed to one another that they can only coexist in very singular natures. Nevertheless, my position at the court of several popes forced me to desire their greatness for the sake of my own interest. But, had it not been for this, I should have loved Martin Luther as myself, not in order to free myself from the laws which Christianity, as generally understood and explained, lays upon us, but in order to see this swarm of scoundrels put back into their proper place, so that they may be forced to live either without vices or without power.
This is delightfully frank, and shows clearly why the humanists could not inaugurate a reformation. Moreover, most of them saw no halfway house between orthodoxy and free thought. Such a position as Luther's was impossible for them, because they no longer had the medieval feeling for the subtleties of theology. Masuccio, after describing the wickedness of monks and nuns and friars, says, "The best punishment for them would be for God to abolish purgatory. They would then receive no more alms, and would be forced to go back to their spades." But it does not occur to him, as to Luther, to deny purgatory while retaining most of the Catholic faith. The wealth of Rome depended only in small part upon the revenues obtained from the papal dominions. In the main, it was a tribute drawn from the whole Catholic world by means of a theological system which maintained that the popes held the keys of heaven. An Italian who effectively questioned this system risked the impoverishment of Italy and the loss of the position of Rome in the Western world. Consequently, Italian unorthodoxy in the Renaissance was purely intellectual and did not lead to schism or to any attempt to create a popular movement away from the Church. The only exception, and that a very partial one, was Savonarola, who belonged mentally to the Middle Ages. Most of the humanists retained such superstitious beliefs as had found support in antiquity. Magic and witchcraft might be wicked, but were not thought impossible.
Innocent VIII, in 1484, issued a bull against witchcraft, which led to an appalling persecution of witches in Germany and elsewhere.
Astrology was prized, especially by freethinkers. It acquired a vogue which it had not had since ancient times. The first effect of emancipation from the Church was not to make men think rationally, but to open their minds to every sort of antique nonsense. Morally, the first effect of emancipation was equally disastrous. The old moral rules ceased to be respected. Most of the rulers of states had acquired their position by treachery and retained it by ruthless cruelty. When cardinals were invited to dine at the coronation of a pope, they brought their own wine and their own cupbearer for fear of poison. Except Savonarola, hardly any Italian of the period risked anything for a public object. The evils of papal corruption were obvious, but nothing was done about them. The desirability of Italian unity was evident, but the rulers were incapable of combination. The danger of foreign domination was imminent, yet every Italian ruler was prepared to invoke the aid of any foreign power, even the Turk, in any dispute with any other Italian ruler. I cannot think of any crime, except the destruction of ancient manuscripts, of which the men of the Renaissance were not frequently guilty. Outside the sphere of morals, the Renaissance had great merits. In architecture, painting, and poetry, it has remained renowned. It produced very great men, such as Leonardo, Michelangelo, and Machiavelli. It liberated educated men from the narrowness of medieval culture, and even while still a slave to the worship of antiquity, it made scholars aware that a variety of opinions had been held by reputable authorities on almost every subject. By reviving the knowledge of the Greek world, it created a mental atmosphere in which it was again possible to rival Hellenic achievements, and in which individual genius could flourish with a freedom unknown since the time of Alexander. The political conditions of the Renaissance favored individual development, but were unstable. The instability and the individualism were closely connected, as in ancient Greece. A stable social system is necessary, but every stable system hitherto devised has hampered the development of exceptional artistic or intellectual merit. How much murder and anarchy are we prepared to endure for the sake of great achievements such as those of the Renaissance? In the past,
these shells fetch a good price.
Time, much less. No solution of this problem has hitherto been found, although increase of social organization is making it continually more important. Chapter 3. Machiavelli. The Renaissance, though it produced no important theoretical philosopher, produced one man of supreme eminence in political philosophy, Niccolò Machiavelli. It is the custom to be shocked by him, and he certainly is sometimes shocking. But many other men would be equally so if they were equally free from humbug. His political philosophy is scientific and empirical, based upon his own experience of affairs, concerned to set forth the means to assigned ends, regardless of the question whether the ends are to be considered good or bad. When on occasion he allows himself to mention the ends that he desires, they are such as we can all applaud. Much of the conventional obloquy that attaches to his name is due to the indignation of hypocrites who hate the frank avowal of evil-doing. There remains, it is true, a good deal that genuinely demands criticism. But in this he is an expression of his age. Such intellectual honesty about political dishonesty would have been hardly possible at any other time or in any other country, except perhaps in Greece among men who owed their theoretical education to the sophists and their practical training to the wars of petty states, which in classical Greece, as in Renaissance Italy, were the political accompaniment of individual genius. Machiavelli, 1467 to 1527, was a Florentine, whose father, a lawyer, was neither rich nor poor. When he was in his 20s, Savonarola dominated Florence. His miserable end evidently made a great impression on Machiavelli, for he remarks that all armed prophets have conquered and unarmed ones failed, proceeding to give Savonarola as an instance of the latter class. On the other side, he mentions Moses, Cyrus, Theseus, and Romulus. It is typical of the Renaissance that Christ is not mentioned. Immediately after Savonarola's execution, Machiavelli obtained a minor post in the Florentine government, 1498. He remained in its service at times on important diplomatic missions until the restoration of the Medici in 1512. Then, having always opposed them, he was arrested, but acquitted, and allowed to live in retirement in the country near Florence. He became an author for want of other occupation. His most famous work, The Prince, was written in 1513 and dedicated to Lorenzo the Magnificent, since he hoped, vainly as it proved, to win the favour of the Medici. Its tone is perhaps partly due to this practical purpose. His longer work, The Discourses, which he was writing at the same time, is markedly more republican and more liberal. He says at the beginning of The Prince that he will not speak of republics in this book, since he has dealt with them elsewhere. Those who do not read also the discourses are likely to get a very one-sided view of his doctrine. Having failed to conciliate the Medici, Machiavelli was compelled to go on writing. He lived in retirement until the year of his death, which was that of the sack of Rome by the troops of Charles V. This year may be reckoned also that in which the Italian Renaissance died. The Prince is concerned to discover from history and from contemporary events how principalities are won, how they are held, and how they are lost. 15th-century Italy afforded a multitude of examples, both great and small. Few rulers were legitimate, even the popes in many cases secured election by corrupt means. The rules for achieving success were not quite the same as they became when times grew more settled, for no one was shocked by cruelties and treacheries which would have disqualified a man in the 18th or the 19th century. Perhaps our age again can better appreciate Machiavelli, for some of the most notable successes of our time have been achieved by methods as base as any employed in Renaissance Italy. He would have applauded as an artistic connoisseur in statecraft Hitler's Reichstag fire, his purge of the party in 1934, and his breach of faith after Munich. Caesar Borgia, son of Alexander VI, comes in for high praise. His problem was a difficult one, first by the death of his brother to become the sole beneficiary of his father's dynastic ambition, second, to conquer by force of arms in the name of the Pope territories which should, after Alexander's death, belong to himself and not to the Papal States, third, to manipulate the College of Cardinals so that the next Pope should be his friend. He pursued this difficult end with great skill. From his practice, Machiavelli says, a new prince should derive precepts. Caesar failed, it is true, but only by the extraordinary malignity of fortune. It happened that, when his father died, he also was dangerously ill. By the time he recovered, his enemies had organized their forces, and his bitterest opponent had been elected pope. On the day of this election, Caesar told Machiavelli that he had provided for everything, except that he had never thought that at his father's death he would be dying himself. Machiavelli, who was intimately acquainted with his villainies, sums up thus. Reviewing thus all the actions of the Duke, Caesar, I find nothing to blame. On the contrary, I feel bound, as I have done, to hold him as an example to be imitated by all who by fortune and with the arms of others have risen to power. There is an interesting chapter of ecclesiastical principalities, which, in view of what is said in the discourses, evidently conceals part of Machiavelli's thought. The reason for concealment was, no doubt, that the Prince was designed to please the Medici, and that when it was written, a Medici had just become Pope, Leo X. In regard to ecclesiastical principalities, he says in The Prince, the only difficulty is to acquire them, for, when acquired, they are defended by ancient religious customs, which keep their princes in power no matter how they behave. Their princes do not need armies, so he says, because they are upheld by higher causes which the human mind cannot attain to. They are exalted and maintained by God, and it would be the work of a presumptuous and foolish man to discuss them. Nevertheless, he continues, it is permissible to inquire by what means Alexander VI so greatly increased the temporal power of the Pope. The discussion of the papal powers in the discourses is longer and more sincere. Here he begins by placing eminent men in an ethical hierarchy. The best, he says, are the founders of religions. Then come the founders of monarchies or republics, then literary men. These are good, but destroyers of religions, subverters of republics or kingdoms, and enemies of virtue or of letters are bad. Those who establish tyrannies are wicked, including Julius Caesar. On the other hand, Brutus was good. The contrast between this view and Dante's shows the effect of classical literature. He holds that religion should have a prominent place in the state, not on the ground of its truth, but as a social cement. The Romans were right to pretend to believe in auguries and to punish those who disregarded them. His criticisms of the church in his day are two, that by its evil conduct it has undermined religious belief, and that the temporal power of the popes, with the policy that it inspires, prevents the unification of Italy. These criticisms are expressed with great vigor. The nearer people are to the Church of Rome, which is the head of our religion, the less religious they are. Her ruin and chastisement is near at hand. We Italians owe to the Church of Rome and to her priests our having become irreligious and bad, but we owe her a still greater debt, and one that will be the cause of our ruin, namely, that the Church has kept and still keeps our country divided. Footnote.